Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk. Good morning. Yeah, this is Tech Talk, and you got Michael Tech Talk Kassler, and I think maybe we got Dave Sparky Saganaki with us. Hello? Oh, maybe not. Let's see. How about this? Hey, Dave, do we got you with us?
It could be me.
There we go. We do have him. Hey, you know the great thing was today. I knew which buttons to push to fix things. I was very proud of myself. It's all about knowing the buttons to push. That's what I've learned.
Let's get you a job at NASA.
I'm right there. I could do it. I could do it now. Nuclear plant management, and NASA space control.
Yeah, welcome to the show, everybody. We're so glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here.
Yeah, well, and as are we, and it's going to be a great show too. I'm really excited today. Really, really cool stuff. Pedro Domingos is going to be on with us in just a little bit. Pedro is a really impressive guy. He's done just a number of phenomenal things, including in the thing we're going to bring him on here. Not only is he a Sloan Fellow and Fulbright Scholar, professor at the University of Washington, but he has just written a book called The Master Algorithm, and we're going to talk about that and get deep into some really cool stuff. Things are going
really
on.
Great ideas. He's a phenomenal writer, very smart guy. He's suspect because he wants to be on our show.
I didn't tell him what show he was coming on. I just said, hey, Radio Chicago. So he's we're hoping he's not listening now and starting to regret the decision already. See, you know, some Bayesian filters on his PR search would have helped, and he would have knocked us right out. The weightings would have gone out the window. He would have said, no, there's not enough weight on this. Bad choice, bad decision. But he did not use the master algorithm to decide where to talk today. So we're in
after
luck.
Today he might.
You might apply it just for this reason alone. Oh man, Dave, I'm just a little bit of quick tech news, then I'm going to try to bring our good friend Jay Geek Trivia Garmin in, see if he can answer us last week's brain bender. But you posted an article I was also very interested in as a user myself of the Microsoft OneDrive and the unlimited storage and how
that is no more.
Yeah.
Unlimited storage is no more. In fact, even if you weren't in the unlimited package, they had like a 15 gig camera roll, they call it, for your pictures, and then another 15 gigs of storage. Mm-hmm. And they've reduced that to 5 gigs now.
Oh, is it that low? Total. I did not read the whole article. I have to confess. I breezed past it because I kind of use it, but not much. So they reduced it. Oh, wow. That's dramatic. That is huge. 5 gig down from unlimited. Down from unlimited to 5
gig. I guess it depends. You know, there's different levels of subscription or whatever. But yeah. The main idea is that they've cut way back because some people were being gluttonous. What a surprise.
Yeah, you gave us free unlimited storage, and guess what? We used it. We used it. Is that horrible?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, and, you know, God knows, that's like your attic, right? You know, or your basement, you know, or your garage. It's just full of stuff that you don't need. But you know, some folks, you know, avid photographers, you know.
Yeah.
Well, video artists, that kind of thing.
That is it. Well, and pirates and people who like movies. I'm just saying, you know, that's where you wind up with that. But no, that is a very apt metaphor, though. I think is that if you you talk to people, the larger the amount of storage space they have, the more things that they'll put there that they never, ever would have held on to.
Yeah, exactly.
The bigger your house is, it's not that you have more good stuff. It's just the more crap you're holding on to. I found it. I would tell people, if you are being hammered by this, if this is a concern or causing you consternation for some reason, there are a lot of alternatives out there. I know people are already, in fact, working out ways to migrate their documents and pictures and everything else over into Google, of course, Google Drive. That is not unlimited either, though. And in fact, it's a little more than it sounds like what they're offering. But their model is very interesting. I find this just fantastic, is with pictures, photos and videos, not videos, I'm sorry, but I think with photos only, if you choose to let them manage the compression on it, so they decide what good quality photos are going to be for you, they give you unlimited storage for your photos. If you use a Google document, Google Sheet, Google Presentation, and so on, as opposed to a competitor produced one, as in, say, a Microsoft Office presentation, all of those documents, all of them, completely free, no space usage at all. So you have a theoretical unlimited storage space available to you for photos and documents. Where they start to lock down and restrict your usage to, I believe it's 10 or 15 gig out the gate, that is when you're putting other things in there, putting PDFs, putting Microsoft Office documents, putting, whatever, it's kind of attachments, videos, and things like this. Then they lock that down. So there are options. Dropbox is another one. That's one I've used for a long time as well.
How much do they give? They don't give you that much for free, right?
Yeah, well,
I think it's like 10 gigs or something.
Yeah, no, that's another interesting thing too, is that with Dropbox, the way that works, you're right. They don't care what you put in there, but they're only going to give you about, yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's 10 gig to start. However, if you sign up to Dropbox with somebody else's link, you both get an extra 500 meg of storage space. And so people at one point were very aggressive about sending those links. You don't see them so much anymore. I don't know how much. I have like 25, 26 gig worth of space because of that. Because I posted links out on it. Not much people sign up through it. I was kind of sneaky. What I would do is, people would want a file. And I'd say, oh, no problem. I'll share it to you through Dropbox. Here, just use this link. And the link would force them to sign up, and then I'd get 500 meg. So
I think I might have been one of your victims on
that. Wait, victims? Hey, come on, you benefited too. This is a victimless crime. We all did well with this.
Sure, victimless crime.
You got your 500 meg. Come on.
I think you tried to get. I was already signed up to Dropbox when you sent me the link, but I remember we were trying to send something back and forth. So what are people using these days? Because I'm always like, I'm way in the. I've got like, you know, programs on my computers that are, these companies haven't been heard of for decades.
So. Yeah. And, and there is a difference now. I mean, things are changing now. You had a problem a little while ago with your laptop, or I believe it was with Jay's laptop. Not Jay Geek Trivia. Anyway, I'm not going to go down that road. But
wife, Yoko.
Your paramour's laptop there. So she had a problem. And the thing is, it's gotten to a point these days where, like, I used to really obsess and just be so concerned about my system backups and how best to make sure that there was a full image of my hard drive. So, something bad happened, boom, I throw a DVD or something into my computer and I could get back to exactly where I was, in a minimal amount of time. Nowadays, I never make system backups anymore. I don't bother. I don't care, because the only thing I really care about is my photos, my documents, my information. Everything else is all cloud-based already. Like I said, Google Docs. I use Google Docs almost exclusively to access information there. Google Chrome and the extensions therein, all my passwords and stuff like that is all linked in. It's all connected via the cloud. The only thing, like I said, that I come down is I make sure that I've got an outstanding and stable and very secure backup system in place for those documents and photos that will not get stored up into the cloud, and those I use Carbonite, and I have a hard drive that I use as well, 2 terabyte hard drive that I connect up.
Cool.
So
sounds like you're well covered.
I don't know if we want to go down this road too much or not, but just the fact that when Jay had the trouble with her laptop, I didn't even think, honestly, because she never clicks on anything. She never downloads anything. I never thought it was a malware, and it turned out that it was.
Really?
Yeah. And I've run across that a fair amount lately. That people, you know, they're getting the social engineering involved in getting people to click on this junk is but getting more sophisticated, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's because more and more people seem to be winding up with malware. And then I needed to get a rescue disk, right? So I went looking online for what's the latest and greatest rescue disk. And that led me to a bunch of suspicious links. You know, there's just a bunch of it out there. In fact, and since I've had to fix a few computers lately because of this issue, for my Yoko's birthday is Tuesday, so I'm getting, and she's expressed interest in this, so I've gotten her an iPad Air. Because they're somewhat safer, right? There's less
susceptibility. There's a lot of S's and C's in that. That's a tough one. And of course there is malware for Apple as well.
Oh, yeah.
And this is top news right now. If you go and look news malware, you'll find one of the top news is that Apple is in the midst of a huge war battling to keep the Apple App Store malware free, and they've found thousands and thousands of apps that have been found with potentially malicious components. This is probably part of the reason, and maybe they're not doing a good job of it, because they let my app on there, and that was just that was just approved.
When I read that article, I thought you probably were chuckling. You were really self-satisfied because you were not happy with the vetting process. That's a very extensive, very difficult, and all that. And when you were developing the WRLR app or your general radio app, a customized radio app.
Yeah, it's called Radio Live stamp, the trademark or whatever on that. But for the WRLR station, trying to get the Apple app released. The Android one's been out forever, right? But the Apple one, to get that released. And I got to say, it's not so much that I have a problem with the vetting that they do. And I'm sure they do, you know, something good. They're looking at things. They've got, I'm sure, a combination of programmatic as well as hand touching. I know there's a manual component to that. What's frustrating for the developer, and I've heard this echoed throughout the interwebs, is that there's absolutely no information from them about any part of the process. So you don't know, like, are you in a queue? Are they waiting? Did they glance at it and put it to the side? They'll get to it later. How many days, maybe? You know, you don't even get like that phone queue kind of thing of your caller number 17 out of 100, you know? You just have you submitted the app and it stays like that for 7 days, in my case, 10, 11, 12 days. And then finally it switches to, you've submitted the app to, your app's in review. And you're like, oh, great. And then a day goes by, 2 days go by. And then finally, you get either approval or rejection. So,
yeah. Well, but it's still a cleaner environment. There's also been issues. There's some serious issues with Android now. Android, I guess, some of the malware that for Android, it can't be killed even if you factory reset your phone or device.
I was reading about that too, and I'm a big Android fanboy. I'll be the first to admit it. My recent experiences with Apple has done nothing to change that. But Trojanized. See, you have susceptibility problems. I've got Trojan problems. Trojanized apps. Let's not go there. I've got three kids too. Malicious.
Well, there's proof that you have a problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Malicious copies of the most popular Android apps are being used, and they're installing this adware. They're calling it persistent adware because it's so tough to get rid of. Now, what they're doing, this is fascinating. So this is truly, truly a Trojan app. We've heard that term used so many times. I mean, from the very beginning days of viruses and computers and so on. But it usually was something that it's like it would describe itself as one thing, but then it would actually be something completely different. These are taking it one step further. They are actually fully functioning and seemingly very legitimate copies of applications like Candy Crush, Facebook, even Google Now or New York Times. You can install these. They work and they look like they're doing what they should do, but they're actually Trojan apps that have malicious code added to the working code that's there, and then it goes right into your Android world. And
the good news, though,
yeah,
is once again, if you go through Google Play or Amazon to get your apps, that they're much more stringently vetted and much safer.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah, and Google Play does a very good job of that. And this is where I'm comparing Apple distribution system to the Google systems. Is it Google Play, Android, App Store, I believe, do not have at this point now with the recent stuff any worse of a track record of getting malicious apps up, but their turnaround process for vetting an app and putting it up on the Play Store is virtually instantaneous. It's not quite, but it's compared to Apple, it's close. It's maybe a day, you know, that kind of thing for your first app up there. So that's surprising to me, but the Apple side is disappointing to me. Speaking of, let's bring Jay Garman in here, though.
Good segue.
Segue.
Past the quarter hour.
There's no segue.
We need to get Jay in.
Yeah, and don't forget, people, in a little bit, we're going to have Pedro Domingos on, author of The Master Algorithm, talking about that good stuff. Hey, hello. Morning, Mr. Garman. we were just
Hi, Jay. Welcome to the program.
We were just complaining. There's nowhere safe anymore. It doesn't matter if you're Android, Apple, whatever. You're out of luck. You're gonna get infected somehow, some way.
You're talking to a guy who spent all morning having to manually reinstall a WordPress site because it got hacked for the third time.
Oh, was it one of those PHP injection hacks?
Yes.
Oh, those are brutal. I had that happen to me as well. I've tried to figure out how you stop them from happening, and I don't know how. I don't know how to keep it from occurring again. I'm hosted on Dream Hosters. I love it. They're great, but it's twice that it's happened. The only thing I can do is I make regular backups and then, you know, I just overwrite the thing.
Jay, we can actually hear the dark cloud over your head.
I mean, I spent this morning, like, I had to, let's get nerdy for a second here. I had to go in, comment out the old install as _hacked, rip out my web config, reinstall and fresh install the WordPress, go hack that one to point at the old content database, and then manually move 6 years of images from one folder to another. And let me tell you, FTP has not moved quickly on that.
Wow. Yeah. Now I did not have to deal with that much. I just had to clean up the PHP, and then it was, here's something fun you can do. Go into that PHP code. And what you're going to see is that, in the header, there's going to be, obfuscated PHP code that is going to look like gobbledygook, but you can take the, obfuscated code and you can put it into a code deobfuscator, and there's free ones on the web. And see what they're actually instructing your site to do and what website they're sending it to and things like that. Why you would want to, I don't know, but I found it interesting, at least.
I don't even have to do that, because when I go into Google Webmaster Tools, they tell me where I'm being cross-site injected to go to. I know that. It's right there in the security message. My problem is, after I clean it up, I have to go in and say, hey, Google, I fixed this. Please recrawl my site so that people try and go to it. It doesn't say, malware warning, don't go here.
Yeah, yeah. That is one thing I got to say.
Takes a few days.
DreamHost was very good about. They shut my site down, which was very irritating, but it avoided all of that. So I have to say, it was frustrating at the time, but hats off to them for doing what they did. it gave me, you know, the site was down for several days, but it gave me the ability to clear it up, clean it up, and not have to do that Google call and wait for the clearing and get you off of the blacklists and all the other stuff and everything, which you may have to look into Spam House, spelled like the Germans do, spamhouse.org, and see if you're in there for some reason too now. And yeah, no, it's I hate hackers. I hate more than I hate Apple. I hate hackers that do stuff like that. So that's saying something. Oh man, but you know what, we're gonna be talking to a guy in a little bit who's got the master algorithm, and maybe he's got a solution for that. Maybe he could just say, you know what, we're gonna create an algorithm that's self-learning. It'll know when spam and hacking is happening, and it'll just stop it, and it just won't matter anymore. Either that, or the hackers will get a hold of it first, and and then we'll do, it's all be done. It'll all be over. Oh, man. Well, and speaking of which, I do have to keep us kind of rocking and rolling a little bit today. What were we supposed to be thinking about last week and moving on? I think it was something that I was excited about, too. I was just looking it up here to see if I was trying to rack my brains on it last week.
So on November 2nd, 1994, WXYC, the college radio station for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, became the first radio station to do a simulcast of their regular over-the-air broadcast on the Internet. They were the first Internet radio station that did a simulcast. And the question was, what software did you need to listen to this simulcast? Because this is before Real Player, all that stuff that just made it somewhat straightforward. And the answer is, you need a special Mac-only program called See You, See Me, which was designed by Cornell University.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember that.
And that was actually not as uncommon a program for Mac users back in the day, because it was, believe it or not, despite what you hear about Skype and Google Hangouts, one of the first video conferencing programs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what See You, See Me was. And it was terrible, but it existed. And WXYC hacked a copy of See You, See Me to do their internet radio simulcast. So what they did, the first version of See You, See Me, by the way, was video only. So the idea was that you would call someone on the phone, and at the same time you would get the video feed through the See You, See Me. Now, the version that they used for the radio station had actually added really bad audio, mono audio. It was just awful. But what they did is they went and they commented out all of the video transmission stuff and increased the available bandwidth for audio. So you would get the audio feed without the video, but you would get audio using this program. Mm. But it gets even worse. So the back then, Macintoshes had expansion port boards that you could plug in to plug into a radio mix board, so you could actually get live audio. They didn't have the budget for that at WXYC. So what they had to do was go get one of the FM radios, and then do the aux out and plug it into the microphone of a Macintosh. So they literally had to catch their own over-the-air broadcast and route it into the Mac and then put that on the Internet. They couldn't get a direct feed from their own board.
I think that's not too far from how we do things here at WRLR still.
No, it's not nearly that sophisticated.
Oh, man. I was hoping the answer was going to be they used Michael Tech-Talk Kassler's streaming radio app, Radio Live, that you can find it. All right, I won't do any promos on myself anymore. No, that is pretty amazing. You know, and I think that shows, though, what the interest level was to get this going and make this happen. And it still exists. You know, this is, I honestly very, very, very rarely do I ever turn a dial and or in my car or anywhere listen to actual over the air radio. It's all through my phone or other internet connected device. I listen to live radio a lot. I just don't listen to it actually like using radio waves. Using the internet. So
you must really, really enjoy paying for a data plan.
I do not have to pay for a data plan, so that may be part of why. Well, I am okay with that. My data plan is taken care of. I'm not worried about it. I've never run into those caps. My wife, on the other hand, does have a cap on her data plan, and so I have to talk to her. This is one of the side effects, very positive side effects of having a radio show where we review technology pieces frequently, is that I actually, some of the vendors that we talk to, set me up with the phones and things that I can use to test and work on and all that. And I always try to be pretty upfront about that when we do review a piece of technology or device that I'm not reviewing it completely in a vacuum and had to pay for it with my own money. Usually I'm getting them presented to me in order to check them out. But I always do try to keep that in mind as well when I'm considering the services that I'm offered. But to your point... I am very, very happily aware of the fact that that yes, my data plan issues are not what others may be.
I'm just saying that if you, especially if you're driving in Chicago, you're not spending a small amount of time in your car, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So, that's a lot of stereo audio you're just streaming through there, Chief. Yeah.
Well, but many times, too, and I'll make this one of the cool sites of the week here because I use this all the time myself, is I don't listen to actual live radio. I kind of like DVRing my stuff. So I use Spotify as a great Android app if nobody's checked it out before, and it allows you to select and choose podcasts, basically recorded shows that you would want to listen to. It's like one of my favorite shows to listen to with the kids in the car is Night Vale, and that's it's like a play and all this. I have no idea when that actually comes on. I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. I just listen to it via podcast, which can be downloaded, of course, in advance of any travel time via Wi-Fi. And so even without a comprehensive data plan, pretty much any topic or subject that you would want to listen to, including music and music shows, you can get via a podcast and do it in advance. That's my tip for the day. That's my hot tip for the day.
Cool. Do you listen to the commercials when you're listening to these DVR'd records?
No, the wonderful thing is, and most of the podcast sites and the podcasts that are distributed do not have the advertisements included with them, or if they do, they're very, very stripped down. Usually you have to listen to like a bumper at the beginning or some filler at the end and all that. And that's it. It's very nice. Very, very slick, very clean.
Well, cool. There's a reason for that, because the radio stations are smart enough to say that podcast advertising is a separate ad buy. You don't get that for free just because you bought over-the-air ads. New. You want to be on my podcast, you got to pay me a second time.
Yep, exactly. Hey, we got to move it along, though, Jay. I'm sorry, I got to bring us down. What should we be thinking about for next week?
All right, so we are coming up on the anniversary 24 years ago of STS-2, the second space shuttle mission, and the first time in history that a manned spacecraft was reused for a second mission. So this was the first time ever anyone had ever reused a spacecraft. It was also the last time NASA allowed a certain aspect of a manned spaceflight crew. So what was sort of the last thing NASA ever allowed on STS-2.
Ooh. Oh, man. I, again, as usual, stumped. Yeah, I have. Dave, you got any ideas?
Oh, no, I'm clueless.
Well, I didn't ask you. Absolutely I didn't clueless. Ask you that. I was asking you a question. No, I.
No. Well, yeah, you already knew that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's fantastic. I'll pose it to Rob. Shot first. Actually, it's Rob with Science for the Win is coming on right after us. So I'll maybe I'll throw that his way. See if he's got a good answer for us.
I bet he does.
Jay, on that. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on again. Sorry we didn't have more time to talk this week. We will definitely chat next week, though.
All right. Have a good one, fellas.
Yep. Take care.
Take care, Jay. Love you.
Bye-bye.
One of the best.
Jay, Geek Trivia Garmin. Yeah, absolutely.
What a man.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to do this now. We're going to try to bring on. This is always, we're always like throwing dice. Is will this work? Can I find? Well, number one, can I find his number here? We're calling up. We're calling up Pedro. Pedro Dominguez. So of course I'm looking.
Yeah. You know, Michael, you make the case for artificial intelligence, you know,
any kind of intelligence would be a step up at this point. See, you know, the problem is I added the number over somewhere else, and then I you know, it's not showing up here. That's always the way it is. And then I got,
you have it in the cloud somewhere, Michael?
I do. I got it in front of me, but I just, you know, it's not where it should be on my phone board here.
Yeah, so unless it's in the cloud, you can't find it, right?
Yeah, well, I need an intern. I keep telling people I need an intern. Where's my intern? Gosh darn it! Then this would all be taken care of.
Yeah.
I think we got it. I think we got it.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Dominguez.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. I should say Dr. Dominguez. I apologize. I've been calling you Mr. I guess Dr. Dominguez. Is that not correct? I know I've read so many glowing things about you being a Sloan Fellow, Fulbright Scholar, Professor. I should assume you've got at least the PhD now. How do you prefer to be called, I guess is what I should ask.
I do have a PhD, but just call me Pedro.
Good enough. Good enough. I won't tell you what most people call me, but we'll all accept whatever it may be. We've got Dave Sparky Saganaki on with us. Mr. Dominguez, so happy, Pedro, to have gotten an opportunity to receive your book, to look through it, to read it, and to learn so much about where things are starting to go today with machine learning and artificial intelligence. And what the possibilities are, but I'm really excited to bring this to the listeners, some of whom may not even really know what the difference is between an algorithm or a formula they use in a spreadsheet versus the sort of thing that scientists such as yourself are working on. Can you help get us there so then we can start talking about some of the bigger topics?
Yeah, sure. So. Well, you know, a formula is a very simple kind of algorithm, right? But then, you know, a formula is a one-line algorithm, if you will. Algorithms like this can run into, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of lines of code, right? And they're very slow and you know, and costly and painful to program. You know, somebody, some human software engineer has to program them. The amazing thing about machine learning is that you don't have to do that. The computer learns to program itself. So the computer writes its own algorithms instead of us having to write them for it. And the way it does that is by learning from data, right? Mm. It looks at what you do and tries to, for example, predict what you're going to do next, or, you know, looks at what you buy and tries to predict what you like. And, you know, and for example, you know, learns to drive a car by observing a human drive a car and so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think you hit on one point that is really one of the separators, is that idea that with machine learning, these computers are writing their own programs. How does that sort of recursive creation? How does that work really? And is that actually happening today?
Oh, it is happening today in just about every area, right? You know machine learning happens pretty much every moment of the day, right? You know, whenever you're online, you know, Google uses machine learning to select search results, you know, Facebook uses it to select, you know, posts, you know, online dating, right, is done, you know, potential matches are selected by machine learning, stocks are traded by machine learning, you know, personalized medicine, your smartphone, you know, Siri and things like that, they use machine learning. So, you know, machine learning is very pervasive. Now, how does it work? Well, there's more than one way, right? And that's, you know, a lot of what the book is about. One way is to try and mimic what the brain does, right? You know, the greatest learning algorithm on earth is the one inside your skull. So, you know, let's try to reverse engineer it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this approach is, you know, called neural networks or connectionism or deep learning these days. And it's really building a little brain. There's also, you know, people who follow the approach of trying to simulate evolution, right? Mm. Evolution is an amazing learning algorithm, right? It made you and me and you know, all other life forms on Earth, so let's try to simulate that on a computer. And then there's, you know, approach is based on symbolic reasoning, which, if you will, are the more traditional computer science ones, on reasoning by analogy, on statistics, and you know, Bayesian inference and things like that. So yeah, it's a very it's a fascinating field, not only because it's very important, but because every paradigm in it comes from other different fields of science, like, you know, biology or psychology or you know, neuroscience and so on.
And I think and I'm going to let people know that, you know, the book is very, very approachable. We're probably going to dive into some things that may sound very abstruse and just out there. But I will assure people you can pick this up and you can read it. It's extremely well written and it's very approachable regardless of what your background is. You don't need a lot of math or to have read, you know, Hume's complete works to kind of approach. Even though Hume is discussed within it, what I was going to get to was how interesting it was to me the connections that are made throughout the lines of thought that we have. It's not just a computer science problem, really. There are a lot of ways that we can approach the issues of machine learning that pull on a number of different disciplines and all that. You mentioned medicine. We've talked a little bit about philosophy. Where do you see those connections sort of building and the difficulty of kind of bringing them as a piece into the problem of creating a master algorithm? And then soon we're going to have to talk about what the master algorithm really is.
Yeah, so, you know, they do all collide in this problem of building the master algorithm, right? Like all these, you know, strands from, you know, philosophy and logic and psychology and various fields of science. It really does all begin with Hume's problem of induction, right? Mm-hmm. The whole question in machine learning is, you know, what can I predict based on what I've seen, right? If I've seen, for example, you know, this person do these things, you know, how can I generalize to what they might do next? Or if I've looked at a bunch of, I don't know, x-rays of breasts, and some of them have a tumor, some of them didn't, how can I predict whether the next one that I'm going to see has a tumor or not? So it's really about all this problem of generalizing beyond what you've seen. And Hume, you know, he basically, you know, posed this very famous problem, like, you know, Hume's problem of induction, which is, if you think of it carefully, there is really no way to safely generalize from what you've seen to what you haven't seen, because it could always be arbitrarily different.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so in some sense, all of machine learning is trying to answer Hume's question. In fact, all of science, right, even all of our knowledge, it lives under the shadow of that question. Like, you know, how do you know that the sun is going to rise tomorrow? Right, you've seen it rise every day, you know, for your past life, but that's actually no guarantee that it's going to rise tomorrow. Is there some way to safely generalize and try to, you know, say things that we are reasonably confident that will happen or there isn't? This is really the problem that we're dealing with.
Yeah, in the example, in fact, that you use in the book, which is great, I'm going to repeat it here, is the chicken that wakes up every morning and gets fed at 9 a.m. and goes, oh, this is great, I'm getting fed every single morning, so tomorrow I'll get fed at 9 a.m. too. After a month or two of this happening, he's happy, he's content, he says, I know now for a fact I'm going to be fed every morning at 9 a.m. until, of course, December 24th, when his neck is wrung and he's on the dinner table.
Exactly. Yeah. This was Bertrand Russell, right? Like the British philosopher. He called it the inductivist turkey, right? Mm-hmm. Is the turkey doesn't decide right away that he's fed every morning at 9 a.m., you know. He looks at all different conditions, and finally, when he's sure that he's going to get fed, that's when his throat gets, you know.
Yeah. Well, but didn't the Bayesians kind of resolve that a bit, you know, by weighing and weighting the probabilities based upon occurrence, and over time adding to your certainty? I mean, they really kind of embraced the idea that there is uncertainty, but that we can work with that. Doesn't that solve that?
Well, so I would say the Bayesians have one possible answer to this. It does not ultimately resolve Hume's problem, although, you know, to be frank, some of them I think are convinced that it does. You know, Bayesianism is based on, you know, Bayes' theorem, and Thomas Bayes was very much, you know, thinking about the problems that Hume raised, so in some ways it is an answer to that. You know, like, the way, you know, Bayesians work is, well, you know, I start out assuming that maybe it's equally likely that the sun will rise tomorrow or that it won't, right? This is Laplace's idea, in fact, Laplace was the one who really formulated Bayes' theorem in the form that we know it today. Mm-hmm. And then as I see the sun rise every day, the probability that it will rise next day will go up, but it never becomes one. Okay, so they actually have a very nice, very principled way of dealing with the fact that whatever I have learned from data, I'm never sure of. It could always be wrong. But at the end of the day, all these inferences that you've made based on probabilities, they could be wrong because the probabilities could change tomorrow, right? Another famous example from philosophy is this concept of gru, which is something that is green until today and tomorrow turns blue, right? So they could have updated all their probabilities to say, like, yeah, this thing is really, really very likely to be green, but then suddenly tomorrow it turns blue. So, you know, Bayesianism is, I think, has a very good handle on the problem of, you know, the uncertainty in the things that you learn, but it doesn't ultimately resolve Hume's question.
Well, it isn't part of that, though, an issue with the priori knowledge that's supplied. So, I mean, you talk about the saying that's blue or green until the day that it's blue. If there's an underlying physical law that is not being used and all you're using is data and statistics, then of course you're not going to know that it's going to change. But if you have been, you know, informed about, I don't know what it could be that would do this, you know, a half-life effect or something along those lines, and that's taken into account in addition to your statistical analyses, does that get us to where we need to go to resolve these issues?
Not quite, because think about it, right? The physical law itself was induced from data, right? Newton's laws were induced from, you know, data about the planet's motions and you know, Galileo's, you know, experiments with inclined planes and whatnot. But, you know, first of all, those laws are only approximation to, you know, reality, right? And second of all, there is, again, no guarantee that tomorrow the universe won't start behaving differently. Now, we have more confidence in physical laws than in just something that I learned from some piece of data, because we have accumulated so much evidence that agrees with them so far, right? And the Bayesians do have this idea of this prior probability, which is how much you believe in something before you even start to see data, right? And that allows them to put in a lot of knowledge, a lot of assumptions. It's extremely useful, you know, for machine learning. But actually, within statistics, it's extremely controversial. Like, most statisticians actually think that this is a terrible idea because it's just putting, like, this quantitative gloss on basically making completely arbitrary assumptions. And the Bayesian's answer to that is actually interesting, is that, like, yeah, you are absolutely free to make the assumptions that you want. In fact, they think that probability is not an objective thing about the world. It's a subjective state of your knowledge. So they say, you make your assumptions, I make my assumptions, and then we will tell you how to update your probabilistic data, but we'll never tell you whose assumptions are right and wrong.
Okay. So in that sense, then, it's almost pushing towards what you were talking about with the genetic algorithms and evolutionists, where at the end, it doesn't, you know, accuracy and correctness doesn't enter into it. It's more of a practicality of what, regardless of what we fed into it, what gave me the result I wanted, and where
well,
do we move?
I mean, accuracy, you know, at the end of the day, the whole goal is to make accurate predictions. Right, it's like if I'm a dating, you know, if I'm a dating site, I want to, you know, propose matches for people that they will actually have a good date with, or you know, if I'm Google, I want to return, you know, a web page that is what you really want, right? So, you know, in the Bayesian view, things start out different, but as you accumulate evidence, they actually should all converge to the same, right? We start out making different assumptions, but as we see more and more data. You know, in some sense, the more data we see, the less wiggle room there is for different hypotheses to be true. So at the end of the day, you know, if we have infinite data, we should all converge to the same view of things.
I think I think you're absolutely correct. Yeah, and that is where things need to go. I guess I was thinking more along the lines of like Valiant, where you know, you've got a good enough situation, and evolution is a good example. There's so many ways that genes could be combined, for example, to create the right type of foot for a bird. But the bird has the foot that it has, and it works. And it may not be the absolute, ultimately perfect foot for a bird, but it's a foot that works, and it's fit for the environment that it has above any of the other bird foots that are out there. And so it's good enough, I guess. You know, in Valiant's terminology, it's close enough to probably, presumably, almost practically accurate that we can use it.
Yeah, so, you know, like, right, so the Valiant, and, like, you know, like the evolutionary, you know, approach to machine learning, they much believe in this idea of what, you know, like, you know, the famous AI researcher, you know, Herb Simon called satisficing, right? It's like, you don't necessarily need to find the absolute optimum. You just need to find something that is good enough, and good enough to survive or good enough to do something useful. So very much in sort of like the evolutionary paradigm in machine learning, that's what people typically do. Is like they will evolve whatever it is that they want to evolve, whether it's a program or a circuit or a robot, for some number of generations, and then they will, you know, once they think the result is good enough or the time runs out, then that's what we use. And they don't really know if there was something better solution to the problem that they never found, right? The Bayesians actually don't like that idea. The Bayesians really, really want to just find the optimal solution, the very best, you know, mathematical solution to your problem, which, you know, I sympathize with, but unfortunately the world is complex and, you know, most of the time you can't really do that, but you can still try to do as well as you can. So there is this tension in machine learning between trying to do the best possible or just trying to do any, you know, something that's good enough.
Yeah. Which is a great reason to read the book, in fact, is to kind of start whittling through some of these. And of course, where I'm going with some of these questions is to say, okay, so, you know, we've talked about working on algorithms that are based on the idea of neuroscience, duplicating the brain, on evolution, you know, these iterative self-programming ideas, physics with inverse deduction, which works great in the natural world, as we know, our Bayesian statistics and weighting of things that way, and even from computer science concepts came directly out of there. How do we, where do we go then? How do you pick one, or should you pick one?
Yeah, so what happens is that most people who do machine learning, both, you know, researchers and, you know, in companies, you know, like, you know, Google and Amazon and whatnot, they tend to kind of belong to one of these schools of thought, and so they either use neural networks, you know, for almost everything, or they use, you know, Bayesian learning or whatever. I mean, I think each of these, you know, tribes, if you will, has some very good ideas and is working on a real problem. But at the end of the day, what we really need is to unify all of these into one algorithm that has the good characteristics of each one of them. Precisely because each of these paradigms is solving a real problem, we won't have solved the whole machine learning problem until we solve all five at the same time. So really what we need is a grand unified theory of machine learning, you know, in the same way that the standard model is the grand unified theory of physics, or the central dogma is the grand unified theory of biology. And that's what the master algorithm is. It's one algorithm that is capable of learning anything from data because it actually has all the properties that you need to learn anything from data. And, you know, we've been making very good progress towards that. There's sort of like a sub-community in machine learning that works on various aspects of this problem. We're not there yet by any means, but we're getting there, I think.
Okay, so which is interesting too. So, and before going further into getting to the master algorithm, just to explicate for people a little bit better, the master algorithm, when that is created, when it exists, I mean, you say it can solve any problem. In fact, I'm looking here. I've got a note here I made to myself. It's early in the book, page 25. You make this. I mean, this is a startling claim. That all knowledge, past, present, and future, can be derived from data by a single universal learning algorithm, which is the master algorithm that you're referring to. How does that not just shock you to your core to begin with, before you can even move on? But then, what will that mean to us in our world? What will that do for daily life and the things that we're dealing with on a very physical and practical level today?
Yeah, so it will certainly have major consequences. But, you know, let's look first at why, you know, this is a plausible hypothesis, right? Well, number one, all the knowledge that we have comes from induction, right? You know, again, going back to human, even Aristotle, I think everybody, pretty much agrees to that. You know, like all scientific knowledge and all common sense knowledge ultimately was learned, you know, from evidence, you know, no matter how far back it goes. And then the next thing to realize is that in some sense, these master algorithms already exist. Every one of these tribes have a master algorithm in the sense that there you can prove mathematically that if you give one of these algorithms enough data, it will learn anything, meaning it will learn any function. You give it the input, you give it the output, and it learns to produce the output from the input. Like, you know, you give it the x-ray and it says there's a tumor here or there is no tumor here. Mm. So there are already algorithms that can do this. And in fact, some people think that, you know, the algorithm that they already have is the master rhythm and it's all you need to have. So on a theoretical level, definitely this notion of a master algorithm exists. And in some sense, what makes machine learning amazing and powerful is this fact that one algorithm can learn many different things, right? Mm-hmm. In traditional computer science, if you want a program to play chess, well, you have to program it to play chess. And if you want, you know, the computer to do credit scoring, you have to write down the rules, the algorithm by which it will decide whether somebody gets a credit card or not. With machine learning, the same learning algorithm can be playing chess today and doing credit scoring tomorrow and doing something, you know, and doing medical diagnosis the day after. The only thing that has changed is the data that you gave to it. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, every machine learning is a master algorithm because it's kind of like independent of the particular application, right? And now the question is, how powerful are they, right? The problem is that in practice, the algorithms that we have today, they would probably need far too much data and far too much computing power to actually learn anything. And mm-hmm. so the question is, can you have an algorithm that does this with a reasonable, you know, amount of data and computing? But again, there are practical examples of master algorithms, like, for example, the brain, right? The brain exists, and it is a very general-purpose learning machine, and so is evolution and so on. So, you know, there are, I think, you know, very strong reasons coming from different directions to believe that the master algorithm does exist. Mm. Now, what would be the consequence if we discovered it? There are a lot of very important problems that we cannot solve without machine learning, and we can't solve with today's algorithms. Like, for example, you know, home robots, right? We would all like to have, you know, robots, you know, cooking dinner for us and doing the dishes and you know, making the beds and so on. But it's a very hard problem, right? A robot runs into the full gamut of learning problems, you know, if it's trying to operate in the home as opposed to in a factory. So with a master algorithm, we can solve that problem. Without it, we probably can't. Another mm-hmm. problem is, you know, curing cancer. Curing cancer is an extremely hard problem because cancer is not one disease. Everybody's cancer is different. And so there isn't going to be a single drug that cures cancer. Mm-hmm. The cure for cancer is a learning algorithm that predicts the right drug for a patient's cancer, given the genome of the patient, the mutations that the tumor has, the medical history, and so on and so forth. And again, today's algorithms are not good enough for this, but the master algorithm will be good enough to learn this. You know, another one is, you know, recommender systems, right? These days we have these systems that recommend movies for you based on, you know, what you rated at Netflix or books or, you know, there's bazillions of these, but what you really would like to have is a model of you that is based on all the data that you've ever generated and that can recommend everything for you at every stage of your life. Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, books and movies, but jobs, you know, dates, houses, vacations, you know, schools to go to when you're going to college and so on. And, you know, the data to do this is starting to be there, but again, you know, we need a learning algorithm that can then learn a really full 360-degree model of you from data. The master algorithm can do that. The algorithms that we have today can't do it yet.
Now, and I know I've got people listening right now who are hearing the optimism in your voice and the excitement about having a master algorithm and are responding internally with skepticism, fear, and all the danger signals going off in their head, thinking of Elon Musk and Hawking. And I mean, even back to like Greg Bear and his stories on nanomachines and how, you know, once it is created and these self-replicating, self-improving things are around us, that we won't understand them, we won't be able to stop them, and they will not do what we want them to, and instead just do their own thing, and we won't like it. How would you respond to that? Why are you optimistic about this when there's other people that are so afraid?
Well, I mean, definitely, machine learning is a very powerful technology, and you know, like any powerful technology, it has opportunities and dangers, right? And I was just talking about the opportunities, but we definitely should also talk about the dangers, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of for us to shape the evolution of machine learning to make sure that the good things happen and the bad ones don't. So what are some of the dangers? I think that, you know, some of the dangers that are sort of like very much in the media today, like, you know, like what Elon Musk and people like that say, you know, this notion that, you know, the robots will take over and enslave us, it's a little bit fanciful, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know too many, you know, AI experts who actually take that idea too seriously. And the reason is that, you know, artificial intelligence is very different from human intelligence, right? It's natural for people to conflate the two because, you know, we're the most intelligent beings that we know. So what would an intelligence be that's not human? But, you know, part of my goal actually with the book is that people, once they see what machine learning really is like, they will realize how different it is from people, right? In the movies, right, in Hollywood, the robots and the AIs are always humans in disguise, but the real ones aren't. You know, the real ones are algorithms. They're really algorithms that are solving, you know, problems that we set them. And they could be infinitely intelligent as long as all they're doing is, you know, solving the problems that we set them and we check the results. You know, the fact that they're very intelligent is actually not dangerous. In fact, in some ways, computers are already much more dangerous, much more intelligent than we are, and that doesn't make them dangerous, right? If a computer can cure cancer, then that's great, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are, however, I think, different kinds of dangers that we do need to guard against. One danger is that, you know, people with bad intentions will get a hold of machine learning and do bad things with it, right?
Yeah.
So in some sense, the problem is not so much the machines being in control. Is, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, like, well, who is in control of these machines? If there's this, you know, great 360-degree model of me, well, in some ways, that's a great thing to have. But if that model is in the control of something else, you know, a company or a government or whoever, then it's also very dangerous. So actually what you want is for that model to be under your control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think at the end of the day, the biggest danger is actually maybe one that's easy to miss, which is the problem with computers as they are today and as they will be, you know, for the foreseeable future is that, yes, they are learning better and better, faster and faster, but there is still a lot that they don't know. So when you ask them to do something, they could actually give you what they think you asked for instead of what you really meant. Or they could make a big mistake because they don't have common sense, right? It's it's the sorcerer's apprentice problem, right? Their intention is good, but then they messed up. So we have to guard against that. But the way to guard against that is to make the computers smarter, right?
Yeah.
You know, computers make a lot of errors in, like, you know, not giving credit to someone who they could, or, you know, like, or flagging someone as a terrorist that isn't. But the way to, and these things can do real damage, but the way to cure that is not to make them, you know, stupid, it's to make them more intelligent, right? You know, people worry that computers will get too smart and take over the world, but the real problem is that they're too stupid and they've already taken over the world.
That is actually, I like that. That is a great way to consider it and to look at it. Unfortunately, I'm going to have that be kind of our ending note. We do have time. I want to know, and I'm going to mention it again. Of course, we're listening to Pedro Domingos. We're speaking with him about his new book, The Master Algorithm: How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Where can people go to find a little bit more information about the book or some of these other things that we've been talking about? And where can they start to kind of inform themselves and learn about the state of these topics today and where they're going?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the book is a good place to start. You know, they can find it, you know, anywhere and in any form that books are sold. At the end of the book, there's a section called Further Readings. With pointers to, you know, online courses on machine learning, articles that go into, you know, depth about, you know, various things, both the implications of machine learning and the algorithms themselves. There's also my website, you know, peterdomingos.org. So, there's a lot of resources. The further reading section of the book, the first part is about machine learning in general, and then there's parts about, you know, each chapter. So, you know, depending on what you're interested in, there's sort of like many different, you know, paths that you can take from there.
Great. And I know that you personally actually have courses that are available on Coursera that people can go and pick up, and they can listen and see you actually teaching and speaking out, because of course that is what you do, is you are a teacher and a professor at the University of Washington, which is fantastic. I definitely feel much more informed than I was before. Dave, I didn't let you get a word in once, did you?
I don't need to. I was just, this one, a wonderful interview, really enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you, Dr. Domingo, for participating in the program. It's been fantastic.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this was fun.
Absolutely. No, what a blast. And again, I know you're busy. Can't tell you how much we value your time and the insight and intelligence today.
Speaking of time.
We got to run. I know Dave's shutting me down. Dr. Domingo Espadro, thank you so much. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. I will be in contact and let you know about our podcast release schedule as well.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Wow.
What a guy. Wow.
Yeah, man. Dr. Pedro Domingos. I will have many, many, many of those links available up on our podcast website. Of course, techtalkwrlr.com or techtalk.wrlr.fm. I don't know. You can find me anywhere. There's a billion places. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's all that. We don't have enough time for this. Oh, my gosh. I got to go. You know what we're going to do? I'm going to play a couple of spots.
You're going to go.
Then we're going to go. Exactly. Then I'm going to go. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I'm going to go. And then I'll lay this out. I'll end us with, let's do Fa 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 by Data Rock. And,
cool.
And we'll do that. All right. Well, Dave, thank you as well. It was great having you. Say hi to Jay. I hope her computer's feeling better. And yeah. We'll talk to you. We'll talk
adios.
To you next week.
See you guys next time.
Take care. Thanks, Dave. Bye. And, of course, that was Dave Sparky Saganaki. You have been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Don't turn that dial. I'm going to play you a little bit of Fa 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 by Data Rock off of their album called Data Rock, Data Rock. Have a great week, everyone. Don't turn the dial. Got more great stuff coming up after this as well. Have a great week.
Sean. I need a fan.